What do you get when you take Harry Truman's grandson and add the daughters of Senator Paul Simon and Governor Arch Moore? It's a We Are Family edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. What is it like to be in the first grade and find out from your teacher that your grandfather was President of the United States?
I said, Mom, did you know that Grandpa had been President of the United States? And she said, yes. Just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head.
Plus, Tammy Duckworth may have been the first senator to have given birth while in office, but we hear from the first House member who did so 45 years earlier.
It was very, very exciting, very chancy, because, of course, most people didn't think members of Congress had babies, and most people didn't think women who were in those positions should dare to have a child.
And can a marriage work when the husband and wife run for political office against each other?
I voted for Jennifer, and I took a picture of it.
He did. He sent it to me and said, look, there you go. I voted for you, and I voted for myself.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 229 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Last Sunday was Mother's Day, a day that's always about the celebration of family, so we decided this week to replay some of our favorite recent and not-so-recent interviews that focus on that very theme. We'll hear from two women who are products of political families. Shirley Moore Capito is a junior senator from West Virginia, a mother of three, and the daughter of a former governor. And Sheila Simon is a former lieutenant governor from Illinois, a mom of two, and the daughter of a former senator and presidential candidate. Plus, while Clifton Daniel never ran for office, he too grew up in a political home. His mom was Margaret Truman Daniel, daughter of the 33rd president of the United States. Clifton will discuss his book about the love letters exchanged between his grandparents, Harry and Bess Truman, and what he learned about his own family along the way. In the meantime, this rebroadcast show affords you the opportunity for more time to solve our latest trivia question, which was, before Mike Pence, who was the last vice president whose sibling ran for office while he was still VP? Send your answer, if you haven't already, to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com.
We are family. I got all my sisters with me. We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing. We are family. I got all my sisters with me.
Harry Truman fought in France during World War I, was elected as a county court judge, a U.S. senator from Missouri, a surprise choice as President Franklin D. Roosevelt's running mate in 1944, and then, less than 3 months after the inauguration in 1945, became the 33rd president of the United States following FDR's death. There have been some outstanding books written about Truman, most notably by David McCullough, but I thought we'd take a different approach on The Political Junkie by chatting with Clifton Truman Daniel, his oldest grandson. He is the son of the late president's daughter, Margaret Truman, and her husband, Clifton Daniel. And he's the author of Growing Up With My Grandfather, Memories of Harry S. Truman, published in 1995, and Dear Harry, Love Bess, Bess Truman's Letters to Harry Truman, 1919 to 1943, published in 2011. Clifton Truman Daniel, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you were 15 years old when your grandfather died, and I mean, is it fair to say that when you saw him as you were growing up, you didn't talk much about politics? Did you even know he was the president of the United States when you were a kid?
I did, but not until I was 6 years old, and I had to find out in school. My family didn't tell me. I went to school one morning in the first grade, and my teacher asked me, wasn't your grandfather president of the United States? And I said, I don't know. I went home that afternoon and asked my mother. She loved telling this story for years. I dropped my book bag at the door, and I marched across the living room, and I stood in front of her, and I put my hands on my hips, and I said, Mom, did you know that Grandpa had been president of the United States? And she said, yes. Just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head.
And she probably knew that she was the daughter of the president of the United States, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
What are some of your favorite memories? Like, I mean, did you talk to him much? Was he around much? I know, I mean, like, were you living in Washington, right? Or were you living in Missouri? Where were you living?
No, we're living in New York.
In New York. Oh, that's right. That's right.
Born and raised in New York. And my grandparents came to visit us in the early days. And then as we got a little older, we would go out and spend holidays with them. It's like any family where the parents and grandparents live in separate cities. You know, we would travel back and forth. And, of course, as my grandparents got older, we more often went out there to make it easier on them.
Well, your grandmother, Bess Truman, died nearly 10 years after her husband. Did she share stories about your grandfather? Was she approachable on this at all?
She was very approachable. She was a great grandmother. You know, every time my mother said that there was a toy we couldn't have because it would put our eye out or snap our fingers off, my grandmother would wait until she walked out of the room and ask us how many we wanted.
Grandma, that's exactly what grandmothers
do,
right?
So, no, she was a great grandmother. She had a great sense of humor. But around her, there really wasn't, we didn't talk about history or politics or her life. We were there to visit and have fun and go out to a restaurant occasionally and stick around the house.
Did you get a lot of information from your mom? I mean...
No. You know, now that you ask the question, I don't know why. I don't know why not. I have vague memories of learning. You learn all of this in school. So I go to history class, and something would come up about Grandpa in that period in history, and I went home and asked my mother and father, is that what happened? And they would just confirm or deny. There wasn't really any big, long discussion about it. They weren't around a lot either. My father, at the time, mid-60s when I was in grade school, Dad was the managing editor of the New York Times. So he was working a lot. And Mom had her own career on stage and on radio and television, so she was gone a lot. So there really wasn't a whole lot of interaction.
Well, it's one thing growing up with Harry Truman as your grandfather, but I'm guessing it's probably a completely different learning process when you wrote your books, like, you know, first about him and then about Harry and Bess's letters to each other. What did you learn?
I had more fun and learned more from writing about my grandmother's letters because that's a period in their lives and their marriage that I wasn't around for, A. And B, it's been written about, but not, they didn't have those letters. Historians and researchers didn't have my grandmother's letters. She burned most of them. My grandfather came home one day in 1955 and found her throwing letters into the fire, and he stopped her and he said, what are you doing? And she said, I've read them all several times. And he said, yes, but what about history? Haven't you thought of history? And she said, oh, I have. And kept throwing letters in. She was very private. She guarded her privacy. She missed the 184 letters in the book just because she tucked them in a drawer, put them in books as bookmarks. She just forgot about them. But they hold together a bit, paired with his letters. They gave me a nice picture of what their lives were like when he was a county judge in the 1920s and early 30s, and then as a senator in the 30s and early 40s. And these letters were written back and forth between the two of them, so you have them talking to each other, talking about family members, friends, my mother, expenses, all of that stuff. And it makes a nice portrait of my grandparents as newlyweds, and then on sort of the political, if you will, the political apprenticeship, my grandfather's training ground, the Jackson County Courts, which was more, it's an administrative position, it's not a legal judge, a county commissioner. So as a county commissioner in Jackson County, and then as a United States senator.
Was it a great love story?
Yes. Grandpa met my grandmother when he was 6 and she was 5. Met for the first time in Sunday school. The first day that my great-grandmother took Grandpa up to enroll him in Sunday school, and he saw my grandmother in the classroom and fell in love with her then and there, and as far as anyone can tell, never looked at or pursued another woman. It took her a little longer. They went all through school together, and she knew him, and they were friendly.
Women are like that. They do take a little longer.
Well, they were very different. You know, she was the granddaughter of one of the wealthiest guys in town. George Porterfield Gates had a milling company, Queen of the Pantry Flour. he built that big house that's now, it's called the Truman Home, but it was the Gates Home. And he built that house, and she was sort of the top tier of independent society. Plus, she was very athletic. If anybody in my family has athletic ability, it comes from my grandmother. She could throw a ball as hard and fast as any boy. She could whistle through her teeth. She played golf. She played tennis. And I hear that she had a mean uppercut, too, if you got crosswise with her. But Grandpa, of course, had those very thick glasses. He couldn't take part in sports. He was a sort of a shy, bookish kid. And they were friendly, and they knew each other, and they were classmates. But Grandpa did not start courting her until 1910, which would have put him at, what, 26 years old? Or a little younger than that, but still.
When I think of the book about the letters, I mean, they end in 1943, and, you know, of course, the next couple of years were so much different. He was vice president. He was the unexpected president. The decisions about dropping the bombs. I mean, was there no correspondence during those years, or do you think those are the ones that just wound up in the fire?
Those are the ones from her that wound up in the fire. There is correspondence from my grandfather to her. The Truman Library has 1,361 letters that he wrote to her between 1910 and 1955, 55 or 59. And we only have those 184 of hers back. So she did, and we know that she wrote him as often as he wrote her. So we're missing more than 1,000 of her letters.
I mentioned your mother, and of course, as you say, she was a celebrity in her own right. I found this fun interview she did with the Washington Press Corps back in the day. All the reporters were women. Listen to some of the questions.
A cheerful reply for all in this intimate quiz contest.
After 25 contests, Miss Margaret, could you summarize for us what you've learned about singing and about people?
I think I've learned a great deal about singing, getting audience reactions to various songs. Now, I always did think people were nice, but after I've been on this tour, I know they are. They've been wonderful to me.
Well, and having done this tour, what are you going to do next?
I'm going to have a little fun and take a vacation.
Margaret, I see you're going in for the new look. You like it, don't you?
I like it in moderation. I think this is about right for me.
How do you like the Secret Service men following you around on tour?
Well, they follow me on tour, but they don't go with me on my dates.
Do you want to take a bet on that?
Oh, I'm positive they don't. I put my foot down on that in the beginning.
Margaret, have you had a chance to ask your father yet about his famous crack, "I'd rather have grandchildren than a prima donna"?
I haven't seen him about that yet, but I will.
She sounds like she's having so much fun.
Yeah, it sounds like Mom. It's amazing how much, of course, she is much younger, but it's always fun to hear her voice when she was in her 20s.
Well, you're talking about Bess Truman and the famous uppercut, and when I think of fisticuffs, and now I think of this, there's that famous story where your mom gave a singing performance in 1950. I mean, I know you know the story inside and out, and that she got roasted by the Washington Post critic, and your grandfather, who was still the president, wrote back the following. I've just read your lousy review of Margaret's concert. I've come to the conclusion that you are an 8-ulcer man on a 4-ulcer pay. It seems to me that you are a frustrated old man who wishes he could have been successful. When you write such poppycock as was in the back section of the paper you work for, it shows conclusively that you're off the beam and at least 4 of your ulcers are at work. Someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below. Now, I think, I don't know. I was going to say maybe your grandfather wasn't joking, but did that turn out to be a fun story in your family?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the earliest and most often repeated stories.
I love it so much.
It always comes up. When I give a lecture, somebody always asks that question. And, of course, you know, Paul Hume, the critic, and my father and my grandfather put that aside in later years, the animosity. So I don't know how much he was kidding about that. He was angry. He was genuinely angry. His oldest friend and press secretary, Charlie Ross, had died at his desk the morning of my mother's concert. And plus, he was dealing with the Korean War at the time. He had a very short fuse occasionally. And that just hit him the wrong way. And he wrote that letter and asked the head usher to take it out to the mailbox. The controversy blew over, and Grandpa correctly predicted that the mail would be 80-20 in his favor. But his staff nonetheless gave him a mailbox afterwards, a little brass mailbox that had the word "in" at the top and the word "incinerator" at the bottom next time he wanted to send one of those.
If he were president today, he probably would have been limited to 140 characters, right?
I don't know if, I think my grandparents, you know, with all the letters, the writing back and forth, I think they would have loved texting, maybe, and email, being able to communicate with each other, and cell phones, being able to communicate with each other immediately. But I think tweeting would have been a little too brief for Grandpa.
In 2012, you made a visit to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two Japanese cities on which your grandfather ordered the dropping of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II. That had to have been an emotional visit.
It was, and I'm actually writing it's a Japanese form. I'm writing with a Japanese friend of mine, a writer named Kinue Tokudome, and she has been writing a lot about the treatment of U.S. prisoners of war by the Japanese, and actually has helped arrange trips back to Japan and apologies from some of the Japanese government officials and companies that imprisoned and enslaved U.S. servicemen during the war. She and I are working on a piece in tandem through email, talking about the both sides of this, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the treatment of U.S. POWs. And she asked the same question. She said it had to have been emotional. It was, but not in a way that's easy for me to explain. You know, my overall feeling was just of making sure that I was doing the right thing, that I was representing my grandfather and my country correctly, and yet I was paying the proper respect and empathy to the survivors and to those who did not survive Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
If you were a historian and not a grandson, how would you rate Harry Truman?
About where he is, I guess. I keep making the joke that I think the most often in the last few years he's been ranked as number five among historians behind Washington and Lincoln and both Roosevelts. And, of course, you know, our family's point of view is, you know, we're hoping that somebody finds some dirt on Lincoln or Washington so we can move Grandpa up. Not likely.
Clifton Truman Daniel is a former director of public relations for Truman College in Chicago, a former editor of the Morning Star and Sunday Star News in Wilmington, North Carolina, and he's the oldest living grandson of the 33rd President of the United States. Clifton, it was so delightful having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. Likewise.
America needs you, Harry Truman. Harry, could you please come home? Things are looking bad. I know you would be mad to see your favorite man prevail upon the land you love. America.
Most of us have relatives and loved ones in our families who hold political views that are vastly different from our own. And we know of lots of instances where relationships have formed between couples with differing political opinions. Think Mary Madeline and James Carville. But what about when a husband and wife run against each other for public office? That brings us to Waterville, Maine. It's a mostly Democratic town of about 16,000 people, including Jennifer and David Johnson. A few years ago, Jennifer, a Democrat, and David, a Republican, decided to run for Waterville's Ward 1 warden position against each other. We know how negative campaigns can get, but what happens when the two candidates are married? Well, back in 2015, I thought I'd check in with Jennifer and David, appropriately enough, on Valentine's Day, and see if the scars from the vicious attacks on each other had healed. Jennifer and Dave Johnson, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you very much. This is an exciting thing to happen.
Dave, you're there?
I am.
Okay, I just want to make sure you're there, too. I noticed the two of you are not together. Is it because you haven't reconciled since that ugly and brutally vicious campaign you had? No.
No. It's more of a physical distance. He's on his way home from work.
Okay, I was trying to make a good story here. Okay.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're still together makes me think it was not an especially ugly campaign.
It was not an ugly campaign at all. I ended up running for a position because there was nobody running for it, and I don't like to see empty spots on the ballot. That's just depressing to me that no one even cares enough to try to do something. And so when I told Dave that I had signed up and as a candidate for that position, he said, "Well, I'm going to run against you." And it was just a funny thing that we thought we would be the only ones that knew about, and people might see that the names were the same on the ballot and wonder if it was, you know, any relation. But it was really just kind of a joke for us.
Dave, how old were your kids? How old were your kids at the time?
Well, let's see. They're 9, 7, and 6 right now. And this was the fall of 2013, right?
Yeah, 2013.
Yep.
So did they enjoy this? Did they have fun with it?
Oh, they thought it was wonderful. They are very enthusiastic cheerers and said they were hoping that mommy won. And I trained them well.
I was going to say, do you have any idea who they would have voted for? So they all would have voted for mom?
Well, yeah. But they're mama's kids. That's how kids at a young age are. They're all about mom until they're teenagers.
Well, Dave, who'd you vote for?
I voted for Jennifer. And I took a picture of it.
He did. He sent it to me. He sent it to me and said, "Look, there you go. I voted for you."
And Jennifer, how about you? Who'd you vote for?
Oh, I voted for myself.
How did the two of you meet? Did you guys talk about politics at the time?
You know, we really didn't. We actually met online back in 2002. Yep. And when we finally met up in person, just we clicked. We had both just moved to Anchorage, Alaska, and didn't know anybody. And that's how we ended up meeting.
I mean, what got you to Maine, actually? What got you to Maine? Because Alaska's, looking at a map, it looks pretty far away.
I'm from Maine. And when we had our first kid, we really wanted to be closer to family. And all of my family's in Maine. So Jennifer's family's kind of spread out. So we decided to come to Maine.
I see that the position that you ran against each other for was Ward 1 Warden. What in the world does that mean? What does a warden do?
Well, you get to do really awesome things, like you can hand out I voted stickers, or you can replace pens in the polling booths when people walk off with them, or you can say this is how you insert your ballot into the machine. But it really, it's an elected volunteer position. It's the folks that are helping out on election day, whether it's handing out the appropriate ballot for folks' districts or directing foot traffic to line up nicely and wait their turns. But it's just helping out on election day. And so 2 days a year, you know, the warden has a job, and that's in the primaries and in the general election.
I think you work more hours than some members of Congress.
It's possible.
What was election day like? It sounds like it was a lot of fun. I mean, was it nerve-wracking? Did you campaign together?
No, we didn't campaign. The only reason that people knew we were running against each other was our local reporter that covers politics figured out that we were husband and wife and wrote a story on it. And it just captured people's attention. And that really was the only way that folks knew. But it is a primarily Democrat town, and the expectation was that I was going to win. But even if I hadn't, we both said we're more than happy to help out on election day, and we didn't realize there was, you know, a great need. There's not as many people volunteering at the polls as there have been in the past, and the folks that generally do it are retired persons, and they're slowly trickling away. And so it was a needed thing to do, and it's not something that I think someone should have to be elected to do.
Dave, when they counted the votes, did you cry fraud? I mean, there's a lot of fraudulent elections going on in this country. Was this one of them?
You know, if it would have been closer, I probably would have asked for a recount, but it wasn't very close.
It's again, you know, this is a few years later, and it sounds like the two of you had such great fun with it. Do you have any advice for people who can't seem to be able to talk to someone from the opposite party?
I think that you just need to listen respectfully to what they have to say. And when you speak back to them, that you need to be respectful of them as well. Because if you're listening to someone and realizing that they are believing what they're believing for the same reasons that you are, which is we all want things to run smoothly. We all want everyone to have enough to be happy and fulfilled and follow their pursuit of happiness. We all have the same end goal. And just because we disagree on the right way to get there doesn't make us each other's enemies.
Dave, agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you really peel back the layers, most people agree on most things. But like Jennifer said, it's the method in how we reach those goals.
Jennifer, have you thought about running for higher office? I mean, we haven't, because we haven't had a President Johnson in a long time.
No, I really don't have a desire to do that. It's not something that I am thick-skinned enough to do.
But the thought of President Johnson, I mean, doesn't ring in your ears saying you don't go to sleep at night and say, wow, America needs a third President Johnson after how great Andrew and Lyndon did?
I'll let another Johnson step up for that one.
Dave and Jennifer Johnson are the political powerhouse couple in Waterville, Maine. You can find Jennifer, that's Warden Jennifer to you, on Twitter at Jen with two N's, JenAK77. Dave and Jennifer, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For much of Archmore's long career in public office, West Virginia was mostly a reliably Democratic state. And yet, from his first bid for office in 1952, through 12 years in Congress and 3 terms as governor, longer than anyone in state history, Moore had a love affair with the voters of the Mountain State. And he wasn't the last person in his family to make history, either. His daughter, Shelley Moore Capito, was elected to the Senate from West Virginia in 2014. She was the first Republican to win a Senate seat there since 1956, and the first woman to do so ever. I spoke with Senator Capito about her memories of her father back in 2015, several months after his passing.
In all the notices I read after your dad died, I kept seeing the words like folksy and rascal and charismatic. He was all those and more, wasn't he?
He really was. He was forced to be reckoned with. He had a lot of passion for what he did, but he was also a rascal. I think that would be good. He was a character.
And he was a legendary campaigner, wasn't he? I mean, I always read that he always made sure to shake everybody's hand. He remembered everybody's names.
In West Virginia, he is known for his ability to know everybody's names. People who wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 years in a different place, he would always identify them. He had such a gift, and he knew how important it was to people that you would remember them, that you would remember their name. And he always taught me, and I think the rest of our family, that no matter who you're talking to, whether it was the Pope or the guy, you know, parking your car, you treat everybody the same and give them the same respect. And I think that came through in his campaigning, and he loved to campaign. He just loved it.
Archmore was elected to Congress in 1956, and then he was first elected governor in 1968. This was years before people voted Republican in West Virginia. How did he do it?
Well, he took care of people. When he was a congressman, he made sure that, and I get these stories today. I met a woman several months ago who told me that he helped her immigrate to the United States because back then you could only bring 2 kids, and she was the 3rd child. And so he made sure she got to Wheeling to reunite with her family. I've met people who sons were in Vietnam and they couldn't find out, you know, how they were and lost contact with them, hadn't heard from them in a while. And dad was right on it, you know, with the Department of Defense, making sure that, you know, their son was okay. He just took care of people. And, you know, they can discard party labels even back then, as long as they knew they felt you cared about them and that your heart was in the right place.
Well, here he is announcing his candidacy in 1967.
With the encouragement of my wife and children, and with the best wishes of my family and friends, and with the sincere hope that the people of the 1st Congressional District trust my judgment in this matter, I will file for the Republican nomination for governor of the state of West Virginia.
So he wins in 1968, and he's reelected 4 years later, defeating some guy named John D. Rockefeller IV.
Right.
J. Rockefeller had the backing of the labor unions, of Senator Robert Byrd. He had a ton of money, most of it his own, and yet your dad won. How do you do that?
Well, you know, he was also the first governor to ever succeed himself, because in 1970, West Virginia changed the law that said a governor could run for consecutive terms. So, you know, Dad was on a roll. And, you know, when you play that clip and I hear it, my, he had such a forceful speaking voice, which is great when he's speaking. When he, when you're his child, maybe not so great if you're not doing the right thing. But I think at that point, Jay was new to the state. People were unsure about him. And Dad just rolled him. I mean, he just really did. He just out-campaigned him. He worked harder. And, you know, he was a successful governor in his first term. And I think he was rewarded for that.
So he serves two terms back-to-back. He couldn't run for a third term. But what were some of your dad's greatest accomplishments? I know he a lot of building of new schools, interstate highways, things like that, I know, right?
Well, right. He instituted kindergarten in West Virginia. He gave teachers the first pay raise they'd had in a decade. He built a lot of roads. He built a lot of libraries. He had this concept of sort of little pod libraries all around the state that are just now, some of them, you know, they're pretty old right now. They're just finally going away. He reformed the welfare system in West Virginia. He, you know, he did a lot of economic development issues. He was really sort of into everything. But I think his years as a congressman really maximized his effectiveness as a governor because he could work with then Nixon administration. He knew how to work Washington. And he was able to really bring home some good federal dollars into the state.
I know he couldn't run because of term limits again in 1976, but I have a campaign button that says Archmore for president in 76. Was that serious at all?
You know, I have one of those buttons too, and I kind of look at it. I kind of have it hanging in the house somewhere, and I look at it every now and then. I think, how serious was that? I mean, I'm sure he was serious in his own mind, but, you know, he was really good friends with Gerald Ford because they had served in Congress. And actually, in the 1976 convention, when it was so heated between Ford and Reagan, West Virginia, with Dad's voice at the microphone, was the one who put Gerald Ford back into that nomination for president. So I don't really think he was all that serious, but he would have loved it.
It's a great button.
It is a good button.
I can't talk about his career without mentioning the ethics problems he had after he left the governorship. He was convicted of corruption charges. He went to prison. What did that do to him?
You know, obviously, a really difficult time for him, particularly for my mother, really tough on the family. You know, it was hard. I think he had many regrets, but, you know, he always had this incredible ability to keep looking forward. And I think even during those really tough times for him and for us and for my mother, he was able to just keep looking forward. I'm sure that if he could have rewritten his history, he would have liked to eliminate that chapter, and he probably tried to do that a few times with some biographers. But, you know, that's part of who he was, and we made it through us, made it stronger, closer as a family. But, you know, definitely was difficult in terms of, you know, obviously I talked about what a great legacy he had. It's hard to have that tacked on at the very end.
He lived to see you get elected to the Senate. Was he active in the campaign at all? Or,
you know, unfortunately, the last couple of years, my parents were in very ill health, both with dementia. But what was really uncanny about the whole thing was I left West Virginia to go be sworn in as a senator. I knew he wasn't doing well. My mother passed away like 3 months before, and I was talking constantly with the nurses, and I was just like, please tell him to hang on one more day, and I'll be darned if he didn't. He hung on one more day. And I was able to get back after I got sworn in, and my brother and sister and I were there with him when he passed away.
I want to go back to that press conference he gave in 1967 when he announced his candidacy for governor. I want to play one more piece of tape.
I would like for you to meet, and I would like to present to the people of West Virginia, my wife and three children, and have you meet the Archmore family.
In that old film clip, there's a 14-year-old girl named Shelley who's introduced. Do you remember that day?
I do remember that day because, you know, the times were few and far between. You're standing there with TV and have your hair all done and you're ready to go. Yes, I do remember that day.
You had that Mary Tyler Moore hairdo.
I did. I was going for some kind of a look there. I don't know how I got my hair to do that.
What did Archmore mean to West Virginia?
You know, my dad had a vision for the state. He loved West Virginia. I mean, that's where his heart was. And he always felt that we didn't ever realize or try to realize our full potential. And that's what he kept doing with his aggressive moves. He was a very aggressive person, and he wasn't afraid to make a mistake. He created the Marshall Medical School, the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine. He knew education was the key to moving West Virginia forward. So, you know, I think if people look back on him, they think leadership, energy, risk taker, and just a ball of fire.
Shelley Moore Capito is a Republican from West Virginia. She served 7 terms on the House before being elected to the Senate in 2014. And she's the daughter of Arch Moore Jr., the former 3-term governor. Senator Capito, thank you so much for sharing your memories of your dad.
Thank you, and thank you for honoring him.
I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know, as long as one and one is two. Ooh, there could never be a father love his daughter more than I.
Tammy Duckworth made history this year, becoming the first member of the Senate to give birth while in office. And the occasion led to something even more rare. It pushed the Senate into changing its rules to allow newborn babies onto the Senate floor during votes. Moms are now allowed to not only bring these children onto the floor, they can breastfeed them during votes as well. As Duckworth said at the time, the rules were changed to, quote, bring the Senate into the 21st century by recognizing that sometimes new parents also have responsibilities at work. But it was back in 1973 when Yvonne Burke, a California Democrat, became the first member of Congress in either chamber to give birth while still in office. 9 women have since followed her, but Burke was the first. 3 years ago, on the occasion of Mother's Day, I sought Burke out to talk about this momentous event. She was delightful to talk to, and I thought it'd be appropriate to replay some of that interview. So you were first elected to Congress in 1972, and in 1973, along came your daughter, Autumn. Tell me what that was like.
It was very, very exciting, very chancy, because, of course, first of all, most people didn't think members of Congress had babies, and most people didn't think women who were in those positions should dare to have a child.
So not long after you came to Congress in 1973, you're pregnant. That has never happened. And did members of Congress treat you differently? Did the Speaker of the House treat you differently?
The Speaker of the House was great. I have to say, for the members of Congress, they were all very, very understanding. They accepted the idea that I was there, and I was there and working hard. I was introducing legislation. The only thing that really happened that was unusual is that I had a very controversial amendment that was on the floor, and it was a huge debate. Who would come up and debate against a pregnant woman on the floor of Congress? And there was a lot of debate about that.
You had to get a special, I guess, some permission or something from the Speaker to get maternity leave. I think that never happened before in history. Look, there's nothing more beautiful than the thought of pregnancy and giving birth, but combining that, we're in Congress where there's not so much beauty anymore. That had to be just a special time.
It was a special time. And you know what? I can remember sitting in committee meetings, and if I was uncomfortable, the person next to me would say, you know, I can tell you're kind of uncomfortable, but you're doing a good job.
Did you ever get any negative comments from any members?
Not to my face. Of course, there were lots of jokes. They had lots of jokes that some people told me about them. But to my face, everyone was great. Republicans, Democrats, women, men, everybody was just wonderful. It was really like she almost had 434 godfathers. They gave me an event, I won't say a shower, before I had the baby, and they gave her a gift of silver dollars. It was wonderful.
Now, this is 1973. Her name is Autumn. And whatever happened to Autumn Burke?
Well, Autumn Burke went on to become a businesswoman. She graduated from college. She went to Oxford one summer, and then she was a real estate broker and involved in energy. She now is a member of the California legislature, and she is really doing very well there.
And she's 40-something years old. How is that possible?
She is 41, yeah.
When we political junkies think of Mother's Day, somehow Yvonne Brathwaite Burke is always the first person I think of because she made history. You made history in 1973, and I wanted to honor you.
Well, thank you, and I'm so pleased that so many more women have followed, had children there, brought their children, and moved on. My daughter has a child, too, and she is out there doing it.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Nice to talk to you.
That was Yvonne Burke, a former three-term member of the House from California, who made history in 1973 by becoming the first congresswoman to give birth while in office.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do. Take good care of my baby. Now don't you ever make her cry. Just let your love surround her. Paint a rainbow all around her. Don't let her see a cloudy sky.
It's time for This Week in Political History. After Walter Mondale lost 49 states to Ronald Reagan in 1984, Democrats decided that the way to win back the White House was to come up with something new and fresh. Package their candidates better. Become more media-friendly. Hey, let's create Super Tuesday to attract candidates who run stronger in the South. Well, Paul Simon would have none of that. We're talking, of course, about Paul Simon, the senator, not the singer. The one who was close with Dick Durbin, not Art Garfunkel. I am a Democrat, he would say, not I am a rock. Okay, enough jokes, so you get the point. Anyway, after 10 years in the House and 2 in the Senate, this old-style Democrat was ready to run for president. On This Week in 1987, Simon made it official, announcing his candidacy in Carbondale, Illinois. He believed in traditional family values, Democratic Party values. Here he is in a PBS documentary talking about his philosophy.
My religious beliefs, for example, tell me you ought to help poor people. Now, my father lived that. He preached that. He grew up on a dairy farm. And I remember my dad saying, even your cows ought to know that you're a Christian.
There was always this sense of decency about him, this honesty. He was who he was, nothing fake or phony. And he won the respect from members of both parties. Here are testimonials from two giants of Illinois politics, former Republican Governor Jim Thompson and current Democratic Senator Dick Durbin.
For just pure decency and public service, he was right at the top, and it didn't make any difference to me what his party politics were. He served as a congressman or a senator. I served as a governor. We both had the same job, get stuff done for the people of Illinois.
He brought dignity to this business. I always thought when Paul Simon talked about the role of a politician, you could hold your head up high. You didn't have to apologize and say, well, I'm a politician. I couldn't do any better in life. He made you feel, and I believe, it's the greatest thing, greatest calling you can have.
His bid for the White House didn't get very far. He finished a close second to Richard Gephardt in the Iowa caucuses. But then he finished third in New Hampshire, fourth in South Dakota and Missouri, fifth in Maryland, sixth in Florida. By the time he won his first and only primary in his home state of Illinois on March 15th, it was too late. And in early April, when he got just 5% of the vote in Wisconsin, he was gone from the race. One person who watched him up close is the current lieutenant governor of Illinois, Sheila Simon. She's also Paul Simon's daughter. Sheila Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Ken, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, your father, I mean, in all fairness, he never led the league in charisma.
Well, that's an accurate statement, yes.
he wasn't flashy or a showboat. He often spoke in a monotone. But people listened when he spoke.
You know, he would often say that he had a face made for radio, and I will tell you, I am definitely his daughter. But, yeah, people got a sense that when Dad was talking, it was genuine. When I am out around the state of Illinois, which I often am in my current role, the most common thing that people tell me about Dad is, I didn't always agree with him, but I appreciated his honesty. And people say that in a way that they wish that there were more people they could put into that category.
When you were born, your dad was already in the state legislature, and I looked through his whole record. He was later the lieutenant governor, he was congressman, he was senator. He was in public service for 40 years. What was it like to have Paul Simon as your dad?
Well, you know, it's interesting because he was in public service my whole life, so I really never knew anything different. There were some challenges that went along with it. I remember protesters who would be not pleased with his pro-choice policies, who would sometimes say mean things outside of events that we were going to. I remember that as a kid. But I also got the great benefit of being able to meet the folks that he worked with. I remember when we first moved out to Washington, D.C., to that area, we went to a backyard party at Hal Bruno's house, and George McGovern was getting a soda from the refrigerator at the same time my brother and I were, and we asked him about Watergate. So, you know, I had George McGovern explain Watergate to me. So there were some pretty big advantages of having a political family.
You know, I worked for Hal Bruno for years at ABC News. He was some kind of guy, and I know that he always really, really respected and liked your dad. I knew that.
They had a good relationship, yes.
Throughout his tenure in the Senate, he was terribly, I'm searching for the right word, polite. He was thoughtful. He was earnest. Would he fit in the current Senate?
You know, I think there are some ways that he would be very disappointed with the current Senate. I look at the very partisan atmosphere where it seems people are trying to score party victories rather than score for the United States. You know, Dad's office was just down the hall from Jesse Helms' office in the Senate, and you couldn't pick two people from more distant ideological poles, but they worked together. They were collegial, and they each respected the other's point of view. They knew the other's point of view was genuinely held, even though they disagreed. So I think there would be some things that Dad would not like about the current environment out in Washington.
When he was in the Senate, he fought to expand immigration. He fought the gun industry. He opposed the death penalty. He wanted more money for education. These battles are still going on.
They are still going on, and probably many of them will continue to go on as long as we have a democracy where we can voice our opinions on these things. I think particularly in the area of ethics, which was something he was always very interested in, these are things that you have to stay after all the time. You can make a set of rules, and people are going to look for a way around them, so you really have to stay on top of making sure that our government works honestly for all of us.
And then when he decided to run for the president, what were the issues he focused on? What drove him to make that decision?
I think really what drove him was his commitment to the ideals of the Democratic Party, that that we can do better when we work together on things. That you know, he would often say that the accomplishment he was the most proud of was working on the Education for All Children Act, the PL 94-142, he would like to ripple off those numbers, that meant that public schools were a right to even those who have severe disabilities. And it was really what put many children with many different kinds of disabilities into the public classroom for the first time and really expanded opportunity across the country. And that didn't get too much attention, but that was the one thing he was most proud of. So he was motivated. Motivated greatly by public education, I think partly because he was a college dropout himself.
I keep making jokes about Simon's charisma, but but in fairness, I mean, the other Democrats in the race were Michael Dukakis, Richard Gephardt, and Bruce Babbitt. I mean, seriously.
Well, you know, you might remember when they started off the race, they referred to the list of candidates as the Seven Dwarves. It wasn't because any one of them had a great amount of charisma. I suppose maybe Gary Hart had the most amount of charisma, and that didn't do too well for him.
Well, I was going to say, other than Jesse Jackson, there was no William Jennings Bryan like orators
right,
in the race.
Right, exactly.
He had trouble raising money in his presidential campaign. Did he talk about that? Did he talk about frustrations like that?
You know, he got into the presidential race very late, partly because he was supporting Dale Bumpers from Arkansas, who he thought would be a fantastic candidate, and Dale Bumpers decided at the last minute not to run. So Dad started with a little bit of a disadvantage in not being there early, and I think that was a challenge. He was never particularly comfortable with fundraising, whether it was for the presidential election or for Congress or for the U.S. Senate. It doesn't mix too well for democracy, in my opinion, and certainly in his opinion as well.
You are the lieutenant governor of Illinois, an office your dad once held, but you've decided that you don't want it anymore. How come?
I think I can do more for the state of Illinois as the comptroller of the state of Illinois. Most of our problems have their root in our state's budget. I would like to get more of the residents of Illinois engaged in decisions about where we spend our money and how we make our priorities. So I think I can be of more service to the state in a different position.
Sheila Simon is Paul Simon's daughter in politics as well, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Sheila Simon is the lieutenant governor of Illinois and the daughter of Paul Simon. Paul Simon retired from the Senate after 1996, and he died in 2003. Sheila Simon, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Oh, Ken, thank you.
It was 31 years ago this week that Paul Simon announced his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. For the record, Michael Dukakis went on to win the nomination and later lost 40 states to George H.W. Bush. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
And I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Ah, but it's all right. It's all right, for we've lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. I can't help but wonder what's gone wrong.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to join us next week on The Political Junkie for the final episode of our three-part series, 1968, 50 years later. We'll look at the presidential race among Democrat Hubert Humphrey, Republican Richard Nixon, and the third-party challenge by George Wallace. And we'll discuss how the politics of the Vietnam War deepened the divides in the country and played into the campaign strategies of the three candidates. You can find out more about the series on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Oh, we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sailed the moon. We come in the ages more on certain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's all right. It's all right, it's all right. You can't be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some. That's all I'm trying, to get some rest.